My talk tonight is called No One to Be, and it's actually got a subtitle called Love the One You're With. And this is part of a three-part series. It's the last part of a three-part series, and some of you have heard one or two of the other parts. And some of you probably haven't heard them, and it's fine if you haven't heard the other parts. You don't have to have heard them to hear this part. And I believe eventually all three parts will be on the website if you want to hear the whole series. And this is based on a very short teaching that goes nothing to do, nowhere to go, and no one to be. So I've dissected that into three parts, and tonight is the last part, No One to Be. So, as you might guess, those of you who are familiar with Buddhist teachings, this is going to be talking about one of the often more difficult to grasp aspects of Buddhism. Because often when we first hear No One to Be, that's not so appealing. And often it sounds in total contradiction to much of what we learn in our culture. And I would say it actually is mostly in contradiction to that. So we'll be looking at what Buddhist psychotherapist, psychologist John Wellwood calls the identity project. And I'm going to ask you and invite you to, tonight, while we're here, but also, I don't know, in the rest of your life, to begin noticing how much and in what ways your activities, your choices, your thinking, your intentions are actually bound up, your reactions are bound up in creating, sustaining, shoring up this activity called the Identity Project. Sometimes you hear in Buddhist circles these days that the word self has become a verb, and this is also called selfing. The process of creating identity or creating a sense of self. What I would call an illusory sense of self. And I'll say more about that. So, I'm also going to be talking about what might happen or what it's like to go beyond the identity project. To instead see or let go or open up to go beyond into something larger, vaster, some kind of experience, you might say, or beingness that is not so limited as our identity project. So in some ways, we're all, or at least most of us, I don't know you all, so I actually can't speak for all of you, but most of us are sustaining, creating, constantly creating and sustaining this illusion of who we think we are and getting lost in it, believing it to be true. It may be a pretty story or an ugly story, whatever the identity that you have, think you are, and it probably changes from one to the other. So we're looking at here what it means to see beyond that, to see through that, to see what that actually is, and to see that that very process of constantly creating and identifying and holding fast and tight to this narrow, limited sense of self or idea of who we are is where most of our suffering comes from. Where our defensiveness and our sense of inadequacy, our urge to compete with others, a sense of our self-doubt, our issues of jealousy, envy, are the source of conflict in the world. So this is from Ajahn Sumedho, from his book The Sound of Silence. Ajahn Sumedho is the abbot of the Thai Forest Tradition Monastery in England. He's an American. As you think about yourself and who you are, who you should be, who you would like to be, who you do not want to be, how good or bad, wonderful or horrible you are, all this swirls around. It goes all over the place. One moment you can feel, I am really a wonderful person. The next moment you can feel, I am absolutely hopeless, horrible. But if you take refuge in awareness, then whatever you are thinking does not make much difference. Because your refuge is in this ability of awareness, rather than in the gyrations and fluctuations of the self-view, your Sakyadhiti habits. Sakyadhiti is a Pali word, and I'm going to say a little more about that. So there is a possibility to rest in this awareness, in this deeper nature, and not be pulled around so much by the, as he said, the gyrations, the fluctuations of this constantly changing personality view that we have, that was in a way created for us through our conditioning, and then we, as children, and if you believe in past lives, probably that too, but certainly as children, and then we add on to or continue throughout life. So this word Sakyadhiti is an interesting one, and Ajahn Sumedho translates it as personality view, but it's the word that is actually usually often translated as ego. However, it's different, which is a little problematic in our language because ego is a psychological term and it means not quite the same, similar, but not quite the same. So there's often confusion there. Sumedho goes on to say that Sakyadhiti is a sense of oneself as a separate person identified with body, memories, and thoughts. And then he goes on to say it's a habit. We don't think of our sense of self and our identity as a habit. We think it's who we are. So I again offer you the possibility to reflect on that. What would that mean, that it's a habit? So it's this mixture of sort of a mind structure, of this personality structures, of impulses for self-preservation, of many different things. So we get mistaken. We have this confusion. And the Dharma path, the path of spiritual freedom, is offering us the opportunity to move through that confusion. So we get lost in this thinking all we are is this ego self or this personality view. This is where we keep ourselves. It may be, again, an uncomfortable place, but it is such a familiar place that we often will defend it at all cost. So this place is made up of all our stories, stories of our personal history, our accumulated thoughts and ideas and memories of ourselves, all the characteristics we associate with ourselves, and even all the labels, man, woman, old, young, middle-aged, our body type, how we identify that, our race and ethnicity, our temperament. Do you identify yourself as an introvert or an extrovert? This also contains all our opinions, all our judgments, and our understanding, all our views about ourself, all our what's sometimes called self-representations. And in many ways, when all of that is held in this ego self or in this limited structure of personality, it's really, if you look underneath, what it's really motivating at most of the time, or maybe all the time, is a sense of, the sense of separation is looking out to the world and assessing. It's always, I'm separate, so I'm assessing the safety of this place. It's always in a place, is this friendly or unfriendly here? Is this person friendly or unfriendly? Is it safe or unsafe here, physically and emotionally? Am I going to get approval or disapproval? Am I good enough here? Am I not good enough here? And that, the variations on that is a lot of what the activity of that our identity project is engaged in. And it's always trying, of course, to make it work out the best for us. And sometimes at the cost of actually seeing what's true and real. Anything you say or think about yourself is not really who you are. Anything you say or think about yourself is not really who you are. Not on the most essential, fundamental, and important level. So this brings us to the concept of anatta in Buddhism. One of the, what's called the three marks of existence, one of the three aspects of reality that we are invited through our practice of awareness and insight to see the truth of. And this is variously translated. It technically, atta means, kind of means self, and an means not self. It's sometimes no self, non-self, soullessness, selflessness, nobodyness, no self, separate self. There is actually no translation for it, no real precedence for it in our culture, I don't think. Again, all those words tend to seem a little unattractive, I think. And yet, this is pointing to a kind of possibility and freedom and peace that goes beyond our ordinary struggles, our ordinary suffering that we are engaged in day after day. And this idea of anatta is based in the idea of, not the idea, it's actually, well, I'll talk about it as a concept now, the concept of impermanence. And the concept of impermanence is not easy to see directly. It's the observation that the Buddha made that everything, all form, everything that's in existence is in flux and change. And certainly science confirms this as well. It's, as I said, not hard to actually have an intellectual understanding of this. But what it points to as well is that who we think we are is always in change and flux. So we tend to hold on to some sense that there's something separate and unchanging. But when you actually pay attention, you'll see that, pay attention on it in a deep way, you'll see that anything that we can call ourselves is in some kind of change, was different this morning than this evening, was different 10 years ago than now. And in Buddhism, they break this down into five khandhas or skandhas, and sort of I like to think of the five flows of experience that were made up of these five flows of experience that come together, and then we say, that's me. And none of them are static. They're the what's called form or the body form, feelings, perception, conceptions, and consciousness. So we're invited again and again, and if you do this practice long enough, you'll be familiar with this, to look deeply into what is actually my experience. Who am I? What am I? So from the standpoint of awareness, from the standpoint, sometimes it's called of absolute or ultimate understanding or reality, we are none of those things. Not body and form and feelings, perceptions, conceptions or consciousness. We're not the thoughts, the ideas, the stories, and so forth. So now I'm going to share with you a little bit. This is from the book Small Boat, Gray Mountain by Ajahn Amaro, also of the same tradition. He's talking about being in Thailand and studying with the great Thai forest master Ajahn Chah. The longer I stayed, the more I began to pay attention to Ajahn Chah's repeated emphasis on the relationship between convention and liberation, conventional reality and ultimate reality. The things of this world are merely conventions of our own creation. Once we establish them, we proceed to get lost and are blinded by them. This gives rise to confusion, difficulty, and struggle. One of the greatest challenges of spiritual practice is to create the conventions, because we need to understand these conventions. Create these conventions, pick them up, and use them without confusion. And that means the convention of our personality, our identity, of being in this world of form. Can we pick that up and be who we are, including all aspects of ourselves, and understand it completely without confusion, not get lost in the identification, not get lost in thinking that's all we are. He goes on to say, we can recite the Buddha's name, bow, chant, follow techniques and routines, pick up all the attributes of being a Buddhist, and then, without any hypocrisy, also recognize that everything is totally empty. There is no Buddhist. This is something Ajahn Chah focused on a great deal over the years. If you think you are really a Buddhist, you are totally lost. He would sometimes be sitting up on the Dharma seat, giving a talk to the whole assembly of monastics and lay people, and say, there are no monks and nuns here. There are no lay people, no men and no women. These are all merely empty conventions that we create. And I'll add this to it. We need to recognize that the strong identification we have with our bodies and personalities, with all our credentials, and with how we take it all is inarguable truth. I am Joe Schmo. I was born in this place. This is my age. This is what I do for a living. This is who I am. It seems so reasonable to think like this. And at one level, it makes total sense. But when we identify with those concepts, there is no freedom. There's no space for awareness. But then when we recognize how seriously and absolutely we take this identity, we begin to open ourselves to the possibility of freedom. We taste the sense of self and feel how gritty that is and how real it seems to be. In recognizing the feeling of it, we are able to know this is just a feeling. The feeling of I-ness and mine-ness are as transparent as any other feeling. There's only the quality of knowing. There is no real who and what. And as we work with this in a more and more refined way, we see that feeling of personhood become more and more transparent. Its solidity falls away, and the heart is able to open. So I'd like you to, right now, just reflect a bit on some key traits that you think are pretty essentially part of you, that you associate with yourself. This is me. It may be your gender. It may be your age. It may be your body type. It may be your race or ethnicity. It may be being a human. Whatever your answers are to those, on a conventional level, they're true, I would think, more or less. So if you think you're a man or a woman, on a conventional level, you are a man or woman according to the conventions and the concepts and the definitions. But again, on the ultimate or absolute, from the standpoint of awareness, there is just this. There is just this. There is right now just this. The Buddha famously said, in the herd, there is only the herd. In the seen, only the seen. In the sensed, only the sensed. There is only now. There is only just this. Is the now male or female? Is the now old or young? What is the actual nature of living experience right now? Does it have a name or a label? What happens when you give it a name or a label? So our process here is learning to begin to relinquish our identification with our conventions, our identity as we think it is. It's not that we relinquish knowing we're a man or a woman. It's really helpful to know that in different ways, in terms of which bathroom you go to and so forth. But it's also important to know how much of that is a convention, is conditioning, is an idea, is a projection. And the more we see who we truly are and first aspect is we sort of relinquish that identification, and in a way the identification moves more towards awareness and consciousness itself. But ultimately there's the whole process of needing to identify begins to relax, begins to dissolve. And we begin to actually just rest with what is. Rest on this ground of being. Rest in the unconditioned. So this ego-based identity or personality doesn't go away, as hard as some people wish it would at times. It's more that we go beyond it, we understand it for what it is, and we're no longer limited and imprisoned. And we see that it is in flux and impermanent, and it will collapse at death. I was on a retreat with Sokhmi Rinpoche, and he's a Tibetan Lama giving a teaching, and I can't remember exactly what he was saying, but he was sort of talking about something like this. And then he says, I'm not saying you're not real. You're just not that real. So I often think of it that way. It's a kind of lighter way to look at ourselves. Because there is reality, and there is conventional reality, and there is this deeper level of reality. So it's not that things aren't real, they just aren't that real. And they aren't what we think they are. So this isn't meant to be a belief. I'm not asking to believe in no self. It's a possibility of seeing that is yours to explore. it's not a, I often hear people say, make sort of, you know, go on a whole sort of mental story and creation and construction about what not having a self means. And you hear some pretty funny things around that, which I can't remember now, but it, often there'll be, if there is no self, then, and there'll be something like some, you know, then I shouldn't be this, or I shouldn't do that, or I wouldn't say something or other. And that's sort of missing the whole point. That's just making another idea and concept, trying to figure it out. Nothing really changes. We're not asking to change anything. This is an invitation to see. See the deep nature of things. See what's really true. And not be... often also then people sort of get, you know, attached to this idea of no self. You know, the one... it's in the suttas, which is the writing of the Buddha. The Buddha was asked point blank whether there was a self or there was not a self. And he refused to answer. When later asked why he refused to answer, he said that to hold on to either that there is a self or that there is no self is to fall into wrong view, and that that would make the path of Buddhist practice impossible. So don't turn from the identity project to the no-self project. That's as illusory and delusional. Just another concept to get in the way. So, some pointers here to end with on making this, bringing more attention. What supports, I guess, giving attention to, or the possibility of seeing this more truly? One thing is our practice of mindfulness. Whether when you're practicing mindfulness, whether it's in the actual meditation, formal meditation, or in your daily life, when you're actually practicing mindfulness at that time, you have suspended the identity project. You're there with awareness with what is. You're not contributing to that. And you're also building your capacity to see through that. So that's one with the mindfulness. The other thing is there's and Ajahn Sumedho referred to this in the earlier quote I read, is to invite you to do to what's called take refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. Instead of taking refuge in our personality, what we do is we take refuge in this created personality, in this our neuroses. We take refuge in our habitual patterns and our conditioning. So in this path, the invitation is instead to move and take refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. And what this means, take refuge in the Buddha, means take refuge in your deepest nature. Take refuge in, however you want to say that, Buddha nature, the divine spark within, true nature. Take refuge in that. And take refuge in the Dharma or the Dhamma means taking refuge in there's a path, there's ways, there are practices to help you find that out, to help you free you. And take refuge in the Sangha is to take refuge in other people that can give you support, either teachers or other practitioners who can give you support. Also, I would like to say that people know I do practice in nature. I bring people into nature to do meditation. And nature can be a wonderful support. Nature does not give a damn about your identity project. It's always living in the present. You can go up to a tree and tell them your worst deed you've ever done in your life, or tell the tree your highest accomplishment, and the tree won't care. It doesn't mean the tree doesn't care, but the tree is only relating to you in your present form, just as you are. And you can get that lesson over and over again. It's quite freeing. And then the last part of this is the subtitle, Love the One You're With. This is another key in this whole process. So, love the one you're with. Okay, who's that? Who's the one you're with? Who's the one you're with always? Well, the one you're with always is, of course, your own self, your own personality, your own body. All these things we've been talking about. All this changing phenomena. So, I'm not asking you to reject it, ignore it, neglect it. I'm asking you to love the one you're with all the time. To love this body that you've been given. To take care of this body that you've been given. To have passion and care for this body, no matter what it's like. To bring this, bring affection or unconditional friendliness to the quirkiness of your personality, to your conditioning, to your temperament. And that will help free you from its grip and its illusion. And that care, that unconditional friendliness, that compassion itself is coming from your Buddha nature. And you begin to rest in that nature, in awareness. You begin to learn to rest in the openness and spaciousness of that and of what is. So I'm going to stop there. And we'll have about a minute of silence together. And then there'll be a little bit of time for any questions and answers and comments.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.